You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA.
One, two, three, four, five, six. Run, 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 run up.
Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Today we'll be talking about the controversy surrounding the planned Route 5 corridor and presenting part two of our discussion about A.V. Norrell Elementary School, this time focusing on the Head Start and preschool programs that will be moved there. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The house lights won't dim anytime soon at a once-threatened and historic Richmond Theater thanks to the efforts of concerned neighborhood businesses and residents. The West Hampton Theater, home to relatively few first-run films and fewer patrons during some matinee shows, had been subject to rumors that it would be converted to condominiums. The Friends of the West Hampton Theater formed in recent months to save it. Earlier this week, Open Source caught up with First District City Councilman Bruce Tyler, who worked closely with the Friends of the West Hampton Theater in reaching an agreement with Regal Entertainment Group, which owns the property.
Several months ago, we started a conversation among some folks who are really concerned about the West Hampton Theater. And what came out of the conversation was, let's put a group of concerned citizens and friends together, call it the Friends of West Hampton, and begin to explore ways to make sure that we have a theater in the Libby Grove area for the next foreseeable future.
Tyler says it remains unclear what role the Friends group might play in the theater's future, whether it will be as owner, part owner, or booster. But for now, the show will go on.
It could be the possibility of the theater staying the same with them running it for another 10 to 15 years. It could be a combination of us, friends of the theater, buying the theater and then leasing back to Regal or another organization. This is an arts movie theater. It's a niche market. It's a very unique situation. And so with this being said, you know, we want to see this kind of activity continue.
Richmond School Board found itself the target of organized protest on Tuesday, the district's first day back after summer break, as the dispute over the moving of pre-K students to an elementary school built on a trash dump continued to generate public outcry. Last August, Richmond Public Schools announced plans to move part of their Head Start and Virginia Preschool Initiative programs into A.V. Norrell Elementary, and last Friday, Open Source first reported plans by community activists to protest the move. As school officials continue asserting that the school is safe, citing their recent spot testing for methane and other possible hazards, more than a dozen protesters arrived at City Hall on Tuesday evening to rebuke school leaders for reopening the school that was closed nearly a decade ago, in part due to heavy community pressure. Also Tuesday night, it emerged in public documents uncovered by some protesters that the dump site was only closed in 1979, 2 decades after the school opened, according to a 2006 FEMA report, produced while the agency was determining Richmond's eligibility for disaster assistance after Tropical Storm Ernesto. The report additionally found that as of 2006, the general presence of landfill gas approached the lower explosive limit and did sometimes reach the upper explosive limit, and concluded that landfill gas was therefore still an issue of concern. Open Source talked to EPA officials about Norrell's status as a hazardous waste site eligible under the Superfund program for public assistance funding. An EPA representative said that the agency had taken no recent action on the site. The agency could still revisit the dump safety in response to a public request. The Virginia Board of Health will again vote on regulations for licensing of abortion facilities, in spite of their June 15th approval of regulations especially for clinics that provide abortions. The regulations under review would, among other things, legally define such clinics as hospitals and subject them to more stringent standards, including architectural renovations. Proponents for these measures say it is a matter of safety and sanitation, but opponents argue that the new rules are intended to shut down medical facilities by burdening them with expensive red tape. The June 15th Board of Health meeting saw the regulations passed, but with a grandfather clause allowing existing clinics that met the original building codes to remain open. 1 month later, the Office of Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli sent out a memo advising that the board exceeded its authority And Governor Bob McDonnell announced the Health Board appointment of Dr. John Seeds, teacher at MCV and vice chairman of Virginia OBGYNs for Life. The Board of Health meets next Friday, September 14th at 9 a.m. to discuss the abortion clinic regulations anew. Like all state board meetings, there will be a public comment period. Fans of comics and cartooning will no doubt be drawn to an exhibition of comic artists showing at Gallery 5 starting tonight. The drawings on display will be from both self-published artists as well as cartoonists who have worked for Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Disney, and other mainstream outlets. The exhibit's opening reception will be held tonight at Gallery 5 starting at 7 p.m. Tomorrow, the gallery will present 24-hour comic day where a slew of comic artists will unite to write and illustrate the 24-page comic in 24 hours. Gallery 5's exhibition of comic artists will be on display through September 29th. For more information, go to gallery5arts.org.
Blue, blue driver, just driving along.
Historic Route 5, rolling and winding its way from Richmond's East End all the way to Williamsburg, has borne witness to and even played its part in some of the most pivotal moments in American history. Two lanes after all these years, the roadway carries still comparatively little traffic each day through Henrico's Verina district, parts of which have changed very little in the 400 years since Pocahontas and John Rolfe made a life here. Because of its beautiful vistas as well as its rich history, Washington slept here, Rochambeau was commissioned here, the New World's first college was chartered here, tobacco saved England's colonial ambitions here, and some of the Civil War's final drums were beaten here on the march to Richmond. The road is recognized nationally as a scenic byway. But that scenery, that history, is threatened by the march of progress. I'm here with Chuck Gates, who handles communications and government affairs for Richmond Regional Planning District Commission. He's been involved in the Route 5 issue since the spring of 2012. And I'm also here with Nicole Anderson Ellis. She's a professor at VCU, is a director on the Henricopolis Soil and Water Conservation Board, and has been very much involved in Route 5 for a decade, possibly more. She lives along the Route 5 corridor, and I guess refers to it as New Market Corridor. And here today to talk a little bit about, I guess, the ongoing controversy?
Conversation.
Fair to call it a conversation about Route 5. Nicole, I guess VDOT and the state have been looking at what to do with Route 5 in terms of widening and making it accessible, more accessible to traffic as more and more people are moving out to your end of the county. And you've come up with an alternate proposal to the plan, which right now calls for a significant widening of either Route 5 or of Osborne Turnpike. Can you talk a little bit about what your proposal is?
Sure. Just quick clarification. Both of the concepts that were put out by the Route 5 corridor study, both of them call for widening Route 5. One of them also calls for widening a section of Osborne. But I just want to also clarify that it's not my alternate proposal. I am a part of a coalition of local and statewide associations, neighborhood associations, and associations interested in economic development for Virginia, all of which have come together because we think that there is an extraordinary opportunity in this corridor, that undeniably the east end of the Richmond region is going to see a lot of change in the coming decade, and we think there's an amazing opportunity for that change to benefit everyone, to benefit landowners, to benefit developers, to benefit the entire region through the creation of jobs, the creation of revenue, and keeping taxes low, and all without sacrificing the quality of life that people know in the East End. We don't have to generate more traffic in order to accommodate growth and in order to accommodate job creation. And that's really the heart of our plan.
Verina District is primarily rural, as we know it today. But I used to cover Henrico County for the Times-Dispatch years ago, and I can remember during a zoning case that had come up, it was actually a very interesting case, it was a downzoning. But during the zoning case, it came up that, in fact, much of Verina was zoned for high density and had been zoned that way years and years earlier by business interests that had bought up property, et cetera, and were speculating, basically. So when you're looking at Verina the way it is today, the county has been looking at Verina in a very different way for a very long time, right?
That's true. And its focus has up until now been on the West End. And we see, if you look at a map of land use in the county today, you will see that there's extreme density in the West End. But the Verina District has largely been ignored up until recently by developers. And there are many reasons, and some of them are just geographic. The river and the way it bends there and the city itself and the hills and the way they are create a little bit of a dam. There's also been industrial development in the East End that has made the West End more attractive. But right now, 70% of Enrico County's remaining open space, that's forest and farmland, is in the East End. And there are many ways that you can look at that land. Developers look at it one way, and there is a lot of opportunity for residential growth in that area. But another way that we can look at that land is as the natural resource and the economic resource on which Virginia's two largest industries depend. Our number one industry by far is agriculture, and it employs, generates $79 billion in revenue every year and employs over 500,000 Virginians. And our number two industry is tourism. And that's also dependent on those vistas, that attractive land. So you've got these acres that are simultaneously supporting two industries. Tourism and agriculture are both growing statewide. So we have a resource where within a stone's throw of downtown, adjacent to our airport, adjacent to our train station, along the James River, and in the historic corridor that links Richmond and Colonial Williamsburg, we have an opportunity to create jobs, to create revenue. And all we have to do is be careful about the type of development, residential and commercial, that we have along the Newmarket Corridor. Not in the entire East End, but along that historic asset.
Route 5 is just one way to get to Williamsburg. I guess that really is what Route 5 does, is it goes down to the Williamsburg area. Williamsburg Road goes that way as well, correct? Why is Route 5 so important as the corridor that we're emphasizing in terms of developing it out as a road to the future, so to speak, of the Verina District?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know if necessarily we're focusing on developing it out. I think part of this goes back to the Route 5 multimodal corridor study started because VDOT recognized that the city of Richmond and the county of Henrico had each been addressing the land use through their comprehensive plans, had been addressing the land use in that area, and that they had actually approved a number of often heard about developments, Tree Hill Farm, Rockets Landing, Wilton on the James. Those are some of the developments that that had been approved by the planning commissions of each of those localities and by their boards. And as a part of that, VDOT approached both of them individually and said, we'd like to talk about a way that, you know, once these developments that you've approved, once they're built, there's going to be a certain number of traffic. We'd like to identify how we can safely accommodate that traffic so that we can be planning for our future. And whether that's built soon or decades into the future, we should still have an idea of what we can anticipate needing to do. So this is one small study of the region that there's other areas of the region all over that are being discussed.
So this is VDOT being proactive.
This is VDOT being proactive, and they actually approached the county and the city and then ourselves and said, can we all come together and start talking about this? And VDOT went and got the money to be able to do this and asked us to bring everyone to the table and put them together. And as a regional planning agency, we can our job is to be collaborative in nature and to bring them to the table.
This sort of proactiveness is or proactivity, I don't know what they but this is typical, I guess, for VDOT is looking at land use in an area and saying, okay, this is going to be an issue going into the future.
I think that that VDOT would like for it to be typical. I think this is VDOT working at its in a good way to be to ensure that it's maximizing taxpayer dollars and also planning for the future so that it's good government to be ahead of the game and thinking of that. That's planning in by nature is to try to anticipate what will happen, is to look at the current situation.
The planning district was involved in sort of identifying this as well, as saying VDOT, look,
yes,
this is going to be a big deal.
Exactly. So VDOT approached all of us, and we were aware of it. And so in conversations that were at first informal in nature but then became more formal, in the fall of 2009 is when real serious discussions, said, okay, we can do this. VDOT went out and looked and was able to get some money. And then in the spring.
And this was when you were setting schedule.
When we were setting the schedule. And it should be noted, you know, these developments had already been, were already in the pipeline. And so VDOT said we need to work at that. And then the idea was to do a study that looks at what we can anticipate happening between now and 2035. 2035 is when the regional long-range transportation plan, that's the sunset on the regional long-range transportation plan, and this was identified as we'll use 2010 data as the baseline, so we'll do a 25-year planning exercise.
And right now, Route 5, what the plan is again, there are two proposals. Both of them widen, as you point out, Route 5. One of them also widens a portion of New Osborne Turnpike to four lanes.
Yeah. So what happened was...
And there's a both projects would include a bridge going over the railroad right there, sort of at the Rockets area.
It depends on which option.
Okay.
They both involve bridges, but the two bridge, each option has a bridge in a different location.
Okay. All right.
If you look at the developments that have already been approved for development, that the developers could go out and build, there are 7,800 new dwelling units.
A whole heck of a lot of retail as well.
And 2 million square feet of retail or commercial. And the dwelling units are condos, apartments, and single-family homes. And so VDOT said this is going to generate demand for traffic. So how much traffic is it going to be? Let's identify that, and let's talk about how we can accommodate it.
Now, real quick, can I ask, is that 7,800 houses? Because I'd seen that number as well. Is that houses in those developments that we're talking about, or is that development that is zoned in that entire area?
That is 7,800 for those that are already in the pipeline, that are already approved, that the Planning Commission has already approved. Now
that includes Wilton.
That includes Wilton. And includes anything that's been approved. Now, those don't have to be built, but developers have the right to build it. And there's other areas. The entire corridor is zoned in a mixed-use suburban designation. We looked at it in two different ways. First, we looked at the existing development plans that were in the pipeline. Then separate from that, and that's the 7,800 number and 2 million square feet. Then separate from that, we said, okay, 25-year forecast, what other, according to the zoning, what can we anticipate based on other trends in the region? What can we anticipate other growth? But even if we just work on those 7,800 in the pipeline, there's a significant amount of demand there. And so what we, in running the transportation modeling, which is sophisticated, technological use that's way above my head, they determined that the existing infrastructure would not be able to safely sustain or support the traffic that would be the traffic demand that would be generated from those existing those already approved developments.
Right.
Which raises some questions. Because how do you approve development if the infrastructure, existing infrastructure, doesn't support it? My understanding is that that's one of the prerequisites for approving any new subdivision is the infrastructure.
Sadly, as somebody who's covered a lot of zoning, that rarely is. But the case.
I mean, but it is.
But it may be
it is the process.
Well, I guess the planning process is that when you approve it, you have to make a plan for it, and that's what we're doing here. I think we all agree that you wouldn't want to build the road before the development got there. You wouldn't want to build the sewer lines if there wasn't development or before you even approved it. I think that what you know, and the study talks about this. The study says if we were to take a snapshot of 2035, what would it look like, and how could we best plan for that? The study doesn't say you have to build all this. The study says as demand is generated, this is the options that you could pursue and how you could do it.
This is a major point of Nicole's argument, is should you be building roads based on just what is zoned and allowed? As if that is, I mean, you're almost encouraging development rather than.
Studies show that it's a cause and effect.
And I would
when
agree.
When you widen the roads, it generates. It's called induced demand, and you will generate the residential and commercial development, and you will generate the traffic.
And Chris, your question of should you build roads based on what is zoned?
Just based on what you might.
I don't think any planner would say yes, you should build them, but I do think that the idea is we're not proposing to build them. We're proposing to plan for the fact that that might happen. Because those developers now have a vested property right, we need to plan for the fact that they might exercise that property right. If they don't, then we don't need to build anything.
So what we're completing here with this is just a plan of development for a road.
Well, and the funny thing is it's not even a plan. This study gives you, they're called concept alternatives. And this is, there's, the study has no power of law. A plan, in a planning process, a plan has a little bit of a power of law, and like a zoning plan or a comprehensive plan. This isn't any of those, even a transportation plan. What comes out of this is not a transportation plan. It's just
an exercise.
It's an exercise bringing, and
it's a $400,000 exercise.
It is a $400,000 exercise, but what it is it's good government. And of the $400,000, a key part of that that's important to know is $150,000 of that was designated for public outreach and public input. The public outreach that came out of this has been praised as being broader than anything of for a study of this size, especially here in the region. And the attendance at the public meetings was greater than anything.
Now, what kind of attendance have you had?
Each of the three public meetings had over 100 people present, which is what you might expect for a comprehensive plan.
And the first of these was July of 2010, right?
I think so. I have the dates here somewhere. The first one was in July of 2010, and then there was another one in May of 2011 and one in September of 2011. Well, all the input received from that is contained in the appendices of the actual study document that's online, because it contains all the survey information. But of that money, there was a significant amount to create a website, to pay for social media, trying to get the word out. If you signed up and provided your mailing address, you got a postcard about the meetings, about what the meetings were going to be. You also got email. And there was a significant part of that was about trying to hear from the public. And that's why we really appreciate Nicole's involvement to try to get the people to provide that input so that we can make sure that what eventually is built is what the people of Rhino want.
Now, what do the people of Rhino want?
Well, it's interesting. there's so much to address. First of all, we know what the people of Henrico County want, because during the 2026 land use plan revision process, by law, prior to starting that process, they had to do an extensive survey of residents of the entire county, and they found that 82% of them want further restrictions on development on rural lands. So we knew that before this study came about. The community was, and when I say the community, I speak on behalf of a number of residents' associations in the Verina District, including the Verina Beautification Committee and Envision Enrico and residents of Osborne Turnpike.
These are organizations that have kind of endorsed what your group is.
All of them are members of the coalition.
Okay.
Yes. They were thrilled when the Route 5 study was announced, because we agree very much that we need to be proactive in our planning. And the last thing we want is haphazard development wherever it may happen. We want to have a plan, and we want to have a vision. And many members of these organizations had been working on this for decades. What quickly became apparent, however, was that the money that was earmarked for community input was actually, as you point out, there was a lovely website. Unfortunately, a lot of residents of Verina don't have good internet access. there were postcards. I myself attended every single community meeting. As you point out, there was amazing attendance at the meetings. The disappointment was that there wasn't a lot of listening to the community's voice at those meetings.
How so?
I think that it's best indicated when you see the response to both of these concepts, that you came up with two concepts. When I say you, the Richmond Region Planning District Commission, the VDOT, the Route 5 study, and really I put it on a lot of it on the consulting firm, Kimley Horn. There was a point early in this process where there were emails being sent on a regular basis by members of Rhino Beautification Committee, Envision Enrico, and residents of Osborne Turnpike, by the end kind of begging for a seat at the table. And they were denied repeatedly until the then supervisor contacted Kimley Horn, and they were basically pressured into meeting with us. They heard what we had to say, and then none of it was revealed in any of the plans. It has long been held in the community, because 82% of Enrico residents, and this is not 82% of Verina residents, this is countywide, because we want to see more preservation, more protection on these rural landscapes because of the jobs and the revenue that comes off these landscapes. And we know, based on countless evidence, that widening roads is the exact recipe for turning farmland into subdivisions. And so if you want to protect farmland, you don't want wider roads.
But I'm a farmer. Let's say I own 100 acres out there, and my family has owned it for 100 years. And, you know, subdivisions, suburban subdivisions have gotten to be quite the thing. And I saw my neighbor, who's been my neighbor for 100 years, they recently sold their subdivision and they got rich. And now they've moved out to Atlee or the West End or someplace to kind of live out their lives. My turn is next. So why don't I get to sell my property and,
well,
and
you
make
do.
My million?
And our alternate plan absolutely is not about – it's about how the development, how the where, and how the traffic is handled. One of the things that we promote is what's called conservation subdivisions. I wrote an article on them for Virginia Business Magazine a number of years ago. This is when the market had bottomed out. And the reason it was an interesting story was because nobody was buying anything except people were buying conservation subdivisions. And the way these work is
So people wanted to live in these.
Oh, yeah. People want to live on farms, but not a lot of them want to be farmers. And so it's the best of both worlds. What you do is you take the 100 acres that you're describing, you cluster the residential development away from the road. So when tourists are driving along New Market Road, they're looking out over a landscape of fields, and you have farmers who are earning money on those fields, and the entire region is earning the revenue off those farms, and the houses are clustered back on the backside of the property. And the benefits are for the developer as well. These houses nationwide, houses in conservation subdivisions sell faster and for more money than houses in traditional subdivisions. And they're more efficient to build because all of the amenities are clustered. There are fewer roads. The sewer and the water is all kind of in the same area.
What you're advocating here, you're not trying to keep new residents from coming into Verona.
Absolutely not.
You're simply trying to preserve, again, a view shed and an ideal of Verina.
We want the best possible development, and we want development that supports and works in conjunction with Virginia's two most significant industries.
Okay, and now Route 5. Oh,
well, I think that vision about development and land use is terrific. And, you know, Nicole came in early on, she came in and to our office and sat down with myself and two of the other employees of the
PDC.
This was
when?
This was in late spring or early summer?
I did. I presented the coalition's alternate plan to the executive director, Bob Crum, at the RRPDC.
Okay.
And so as part of that, you know, Nicole says that maybe the consultant didn't do the best at listening to the opinions. But I would say that part of the reason, just because it's not reflected in the transportation planning document, doesn't mean that they didn't listen. The problem is that this quarter study that we are engaged in does not address land use. It doesn't address zoning. It doesn't address, there's no authority. We don't have the authority to do that. Instead, what it did is it looked at, based on the decisions, the land use decisions that have already been made by entities that are not us, how can we plan for growth? Or how can we plan for the transportation? And the growth is naturally coming based on decisions made elsewhere. So how can we do that? And I think that the importance to realize is, the vision, if we have a vision, how do we accomplish the vision? I would say that you can come talk to my agency and my employer as much as you want about the vision with tourism and agricultural preservation. We have no authority to do anything on that. However, like Nicole says, as she talks about the impact, transportation does have an impact in that regard. And that's why the study goes out of its way to talk about these are just merely options to be implemented as demand arises.
I don't know if either of you are qualified. I'm sure you're qualified to, but can speak to this. But you know, it's you're saying, and I guess you're saying too, that you know the push pull here is between what is development going to look like, and can roads, when you're planning them, take into account what development will look like. It's almost as if we're planning roads and the actual development in sort of like silos, I guess.
Well, and I would say that it depends on, there isn't one body in our government. Our government diversifies the decision making. There isn't one body that makes every decision. And we're grateful for that, in many ways, but different decisions should be impacted by other previous decisions. And so this corridor study doesn't have the authority to look at land use, but it does look at the past decisions of land use and says, okay, how can we manage, how can we accommodate those decisions which have been made? We need to plan for the future.
So what now, you're saying, it can't take into account the desired method of land conservation,
correct.
or
so,
how?
So this plan doesn't have the authority to say, well, you have to cluster homes or you have to set them back. It doesn't have the authority to do that. That is a zoning decision that is done through the comprehensive planning process.
Now, Nicole, how would clustering affect what the road would need to look like, though?
Well,
and that's something that I don't fully understand. If you still have the same number of houses in a cluster development that is still allowing farming and looks pretty, you're still going to have the same number of cars coming out of that neighborhood at some point during the day. Because mood doesn't affect that I have to go to the grocery store at a certain time or take the kids to school. So aren't I still going to need four lanes?
You are. And managing the how of the development is part of that. And we also, our alternate plan also has a traffic portion of it. Everyone who's worked on this coalition, as I'm doing it in their free time, volunteering, and we have a number of traffic engineers and architects who've been involved in this. And part of what we're pushing for is connectivity. So when you have subdivisions, that they connect to the existing street network. So as you point out, if you need to go to the grocery store, there's no reason why the same old traditional subdivision that has a single point of entrance, every single route, every single trip you take has to get on Newmarket. Well, we'd like that to be redesigned. But I do need to address a couple of the points that Chuck made earlier. One,
we don't
is,
want to turn into a debate.
No. But I just
make her argument.
I know, because I see you both
do.
Over there with your pens.
On clustering, I think especially, I think one way to describe clustering.
Well, let's let Nicole.
I want to point out, because you alluded to the fact that and you did make the point, and I appreciate that I've heard repeatedly that this is just a traffic study. It's just a traffic study, but it profoundly impacts land use and economic development in the corridor. So it's very hard to extricate the two things. But if you want me to point to examples of how the consultants, I think, didn't do a good job of listening to the community, a couple of very concrete examples. You've got two possible ways of entering the city. One would run a bridge over the railroad track and block the view from Libby Hill, the view for which the city of Richmond was named. The view that today received a national award from the Academy of Landscape Architects. The mayor was there today receiving this award. The idea of proposing blocking that view shows an absolute failure of awareness of what would be acceptable to the community of Churchill. The second option would run the road straight through a planned memorial park for the Fulton Hill community, a memorial that was to memorialize basically how poorly this community had been treated in the planning of the city of Richmond. And again, the fact that the consultants were not aware of that indicates to me that they were out of touch with the community. In addition, the Richmond City Planning Commission has voted to oppose both concepts because they feel that they're a failure to improve connectivity, that actually because widening the road would generate worse traffic, it's not a solution. Delegate Jennifer McClellan has written a letter to the RRPDC opposing both concepts for the same reason and because of their negative impacts on the industries that impact her constituents. Senator Donald McEachin has done the same thing. They're doing that because of the way their constituents feel.
I wouldn't doubt that. The post office is pretty tough these days. It's on its last legs these days. But and it is a rural route. I guess my question would be this: is since this is really at this point an exercise, that this is not a concrete plan, that it really is supposed to be something that is preparing for a future, that presumably will have a better view of what development out there is going to look like. And obviously we have a finite budget for this. We don't want to just keep spending more money on exercise. I mean, we're all getting around no matter what. Can we go back and talk some more about this?
Exactly. I mean, that's part of the planning process. You put out ideas as a straw man and see where it goes and see how things happen and you refine them. Now,
well, at what point is this ad nauseum, though? I mean, how long can this process go on?
We've done this. We've done this proposal or this proposed options, and now as you listen to the feedback from the people, the decision makers, I mean, Nicole just alluded to it. The Planning Commission has used the feedback from the study and from the community members to make a decision. That is part of what, that's the how the sausage is made in government. And I did want to address a couple of the assertions. I mean, one thing that Nicole, you talk about blocking the view from Liberty Hill, but nothing's been found, nothing's been demonstrated that that's going to occur. The location of the bridge, the height of the bridge, there's been nothing shown that view will actually be impeded. We value the view from Libby Hill. We agree with that. We think it's fantastic, but none of the modeling shows that. In fact, the location of it, if you look at it, is actually more along the sight lines of where you're already looking at the existing structures of Rockets Landing.
They both dump onto Main Street.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's right there, just inside the city line.
Almost as if you'd be realigning where that is
a little bit. It's realigning it slightly so that there's less of an S curve there by right on the city line, and also it's elevating it. Those two streets would actually come together at an intersection above. Right there, there's actually two rail lines that cross with Route 5, and so to accommodate that. We need to improve safety by there has to be higher clearance levels for the trains. And we have to, if option one was to be built, that's a big part of this. You know, the idea is that you would lift that. Now, the view from Libby Hill is important. I haven't heard anybody that says they want to block the view, but we also haven't had anybody shown that it will block it because of where it's located. That is a big concern that needs to continue, that decision makers need to be aware of. In option two, there's no hill there. The bridge that will go over CSX is a few miles away from that location. It's in a different location. It's not even near the river. I think
A hill. It's a park. It was running through a park.
Gushing of the park never came up during the actual study. And as a result, when it did come up at the very end, the study team came back and said, well, that's a very good point. We need to make sure that we come up with an option that addresses that. And working with Cynthia Newbill on the city council, she's brought that up, and she's working, and the city of Richmond has already started to figure out an alteration to that option that would allow for the park to remain untouched. That's why we have this process. None of us is perfect.
You know, I can't speak for the entire coalition when I say this, but personally, I don't regret this experience, because what happened was when we went to Tyrone Nelson was elected. I think he was elected in part because people in Verona were frustrated with the path that was being taken, including development. And we met with him during his election, and we met with him shortly after his election. And he said, if you want me to say no to both of these concepts, you need to give me something to say yes to. And that's how this coalition was born. And I think that the Route 5 study has given birth to really its purpose. I mean, the RRPDC, as Chuck has said, I mean, there's some great benefits because there is regional collaboration. It is not regional collaboration necessarily behind either of these two plans, but groups in Verina and the groups I mentioned earlier, in addition to the Church Hill Association, residents of Marion Hill, business owners in Shaco Bottom, and statewide organizations, Scenic Virginia, Historic Richmond Foundation, Preservation Virginia, all coming together. There are more than a dozen groups, and coming together to really create a long-term vision that is the best of both worlds, has the green. And the way we perceive the challenge that we're facing, Richmond can be a city that's sandwiched between a short pump on the west end, for better or for worse, and a short pump on the east end, for better or for worse.
So what would Route 5 look like under your plan? I mean,
it would remain a two-lane historic road. It's the second oldest road in America, and it was the second road in Virginia to be designated a scenic byway.
Now, you'd be using some roundabouts here and there
That's part of our traffic calming. Exactly. Traffic calming techniques, which we've looked at because they've been used. Everything in our alternate plan has been tried and tested somewhere in Virginia, including the roundabouts, which have been very successfully used in Loudoun County. And we have used the Route 50 example to figure out how much traffic we could accommodate. And our traffic engineers have figured out that we can accommodate on Newmarket Road with the data that we took from the Route 5 study, the numbers that Chuck was using earlier, we can accommodate all of that traffic using roundabouts. And that's using traditional build-out. That's assuming that we don't have land that doesn't get developed because people have easier access to easements or any of the other changes that would that would lower the amount of density. That's just at traditional density, we can accommodate it.
When Nicole came and talked to us at the PDC in the spring, she gave a presentation and didn't have the transportation alternative. And that was our feedback to her, was to say, Nicole, we need... If we're going to talk about the transportation aspect of this, we need you to come up with a transportation alternative.
When Tyrone Nelson asked us for an alternate plan, we came together with experts from all different areas. Our effort was not to convince you. Our effort was to convince our elected officials. Road widening and the consequences of that on agriculture and tourism are the most egregious failures of these two concepts.
So that would be devastating to Route 5.
It would be devastating to Virginia. These are our two largest industries, and they are growing, and we have an extraordinary opportunity with this land adjacent to our capital city. We can be using them to generate jobs and to make money while accommodating some growth, and to ignore that opportunity and actually to spend $70 million to scuttle that opportunity is seems like poor planning.
The good news is we're not road builders. We're planners. And our job is to take the idea of take the concepts that have been endorsed and approved by our elected officials and to say, okay, what is the scenario going to look like in 2035? And how can we accommodate that based on decisions that have been made? One thing Nicole and I totally agree on is that the current there is not a traffic problem on Route 5 right now. You know, and
can I speak for a moment just to the idea of what is it planning ahead for what it's going to look like?
Okay.
The community was very involved in the revision of the 2026 land use plan. And one of the things that that plan did was establish special character protection areas in Enrico County. And these are areas that for scenic, historic, or cultural value need to be preserved. And there are five in the entire county, and four of them are in the Newmarket corridor. One is Marion Hill, one is Newmarket Road itself, one is the James River, and one is Osborne Turnpike. And according to the land use plan, which was this countywide extensive process, and doing exactly what Chuck is talking about, which is looking ahead,
was fairly successful for Verina, right? I mean, what Verina got out of that process,
I mean, it was,
Verina was
an enormous document, and there were people that were happy with parts of it. Nobody was happy with all of it, I think, everyone. But one of the things that the community of Verina was thrilled about was the special character protection areas. All these years later, the criteria for those have not yet been established. So one of our main points in our alternate plan is we need to establish those criteria. If you're going to be developing in these four areas, all of which are touched by the Route 5 study, we need to make sure that development in these areas meets certain standards. Well, you can't meet standards that haven't been set. So one of our first things is we need to go ahead and set those standards.
Nicole Anderson Ellis, who is one of our elected officials in Henrico, but also has been involved in the Route 5 issue of growth and density, frankly, for the last decade. And Chuck Gates with the, and I'm going to use his card so I can get this right, with the Richmond Regional Planning District Commission. Thank you guys for coming and talking about Route 5.
Thank you. Thank you.
Driving alone, searching this endless highway for a shoulder to cry on.
Broadcast of Open Source RVA on WRIR is sponsored in part by Haberdasher Corporate Apparel, a locally owned, SWAM-certified, woman-owned business providing uniforms, logo apparel, t-shirts, and promotional products to businesses, schools, and nonprofits in Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic region. More about Haberdasher can be found on Facebook and the web at haberdashercorporateapparel.com or by calling 804-878-7630. Thank you, Haberdasher.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity.
It's been no easy week for Richmond Public Schools officials as they've fended off criticism of plans to move a part of their early childhood education program into the long-shuttered and, critics say, toxic Norrell Elementary. But what threatens to be lost in the static is the program itself. Norrell, when it opens this Monday, will become one of three centers for excellence in Richmond schools. Each center is home to programs that offer far more than free daycare for parents of young children. In fact, the programs play a vital role in preparing young, potentially at-risk children for better futures. I'm here today with Carolyn Tyler, Head Start Manager for Richmond Public Schools, Ron Robertson, Manager of the Virginia Preschool Program with Richmond Public Schools, and back again with Vicki Oakley, who's the Chief Academic Officer with Richmond Public Schools. And we're going to talk about one of, or all of, the Centers for Excellence in Richmond Public Schools. One, of course, is at Blackwell. One is at Maymont, and then of course we're about to move one to Norrell that had been previously at MLK, and MLK, once it is rebuilt and opens back up to the world, we will have that school back at MLK. First of all, I guess, can you tell me a little bit about what programs are contained in this Center for Excellence, or these Centers for Excellence? We have, of course, Head Start.
We have Head Start, we have Virginia Preschool Initiative, and with Head Start we serve 3 and 4 year olds. VPI serves 4-year-old children, and then we also have the preschool exception to ed class there at MLK and at all of our centers.
Okay, and in total, in all of these programs with the preschool exceptional ed, VPI, and the Head Start, how many kids are in the program total? Does anybody know?
We're looking at over 1,700 kids annually, and that we serve across the district.
So this is like a large high school, basically.
Very large. Because we also have a waiting list.
And hopefully future high schools.
Beyond our capacity to
wow.
handle it.
How many people are on the waiting list, or how many kids?
It averages maybe 100, 200 a year. And it rotates as parents move in and out of the city.
And we're trying to expand this program, presumably?
We would love to, but...
If there was funding, we would love to be able to expand the program to include all of the children that qualify.
Now, going back,
Head Start.
Head Start started way
back. Way
back.
It's been around for about 47 years. It started
years.
In 1965 during President Johnson's administration. And it was this premier preschool program for low-income children to give them the same start that other children, to provide them with experiences.
But we had a gap between Head Start and kindergarten, right? And that's where VPI picked up.
Absolutely. VPI comes in and sort of closes the gap, so to speak.
And VPI dates to Tim Kaine's administration?
Actually, before his administration. It came along in 1995, 96. During the time of Mark Warner, actually, Governor Warner. And then, of course, Governor Kaine expanded that and went into universal preschool and things of that nature, which really...
Which was a dream, but...
Absolutely.
We didn't quite make it there. So what is VPI able to do at this point? Does it pick up the kids who come out of Head Start?
Definitely. We still identify needs. That's number one.
Okay.
And we identify them not just in the low-income category, but across the family itself. You may have varying needs that children will experience within their own family and that we identify
but
and makes them eligible.
VPI also picks up some other kids too, right? I mean, you're not just dealing with the kids coming out of Head Start who maybe needed that Head Start. Is this correct?
It expands.
Okay, so it's the same population.
So it's the same population of children. First, children, we send them to Head Start.
Mm-hmm.
If they meet that criteria, and then if they don't meet that criteria, then we move them. Then they can qualify for VPI.
And this is important. And I guess we were talking a little bit before the broadcast about this: is that Head Start is not necessarily income qualified.
Yes.
VPI is not necessarily income qualified, but Head Start is.
Head Start is.
Okay. All right. So then VPI can who's going to be at these schools when you go there? You'll see kids that come from Head Start programs that maybe are from, again, lower income families or just from situations at home that are difficult, all the way up to families that, once you get to VPI, that are middle income or upper middle income families.
Mostly lower income to middle income, you will find that's where it stops pretty much. And that's sometimes a choice of the family, but oftentimes as a result of identification of needs. Because we have a scale that we look at, and we call it the criteria checklist. and we identify needs based on that scale.
Now, is there's a value to keeping these programs in a single facility, which is why you've created these centers of excellence.
The centers of excellence are absolutely fantastic because we're able to focus exactly on what these 3 and 4 year old students need: early literacy skills, early numeracy skills. The children are all together and they can interact together, and the teachers plan together, and art activities and music and the other types of activities that you would bring in are all geared to this age group, which is phenomenal.
Do they have like an administrator for each of these centers for excellence?
There is a lead at each of the sites.
So like a lead teacher?
A lead teacher, yes.
Okay, all right. So that kind of coordinates the effort.
That's correct.
Okay. And we were also discussing, too, that this is not a program that ends at in fact, it actually starts, I guess, well before you get to the schoolhouse door.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, because we really do comprehensive services, and we really work with the family. We don't just work with the child, but we work with the entire family, ensuring that children are healthy, because one of the things that we know about children, when children are healthy, they learn. When there are other issues or health concerns, it makes it more difficult and challenging for children to learn.
So this can be diet, or it can be existing conditions,
yes,
that are just health
related
issues. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're providing some checkup,
yes,
and family sort of best practices for families?
Yes, and what we do is we review their health documents, and if there are any needs identified, we work with the family to make sure that those needs are corrected. We actually connect families to resources. A lot of times families are not aware of those resources that can really help the family.
Is this, it's building parenting skills as well?
Parenting skills, exactly. We have parent meetings where we meet with families. We also do home visits where we go into the home and we work with the family to identify their strengths and also to identify any strengths that they may have. And we set goals with them along with strategies, and we measure that at the end of the year to really see how many families really complete those goals.
Hmm.
And some of those goals could be as simple as getting a driver's license or going back to school to further their education.
So you're really encouraging the parents to step up a level, so to speak.
Yes, because what we know about children is when, you know, parents are involved, when families' needs are met, those children thrive.
I'd love to see something like, I guess, I don't know that this kind of data exists, but what it looks like, I guess, once these kids get to elementary school, the level of involvement of the parents in PTA?
We have a strong policy council that shares in the decision-making for the Head Start program. And what we find, we actually train those parents,
mm-hmm,
how to be in that type of body, a board. And so what we find is they want to stay with Head Start because that's where they feel comfortable.
Right.
But we encourage them to become a part of the PTA.
So everybody gets a copy of Robert's Rules as they
leave. Yes, they learn parliamentary procedures. We have officers, and they actually run the meeting. And they actually operate in committees. So they have committees just like a PTA.
So this is it's like training.
Yes.
It really is training. Now, what kind of, I guess, data do you have to show what the results of a program like this are? And is there data that would be segmented to show sort of what is, I guess, the difference since VPI has come into existence?
Actually, we have an excellent curriculum to start there.
Okay.
that creates all the positive outcomes that we're looking for academically. As Ms. Tyler mentioned, you know, we serve the whole child, but on the academic level, we have an awesome curriculum that builds the strengths of children and prepare them, particularly in literacy and numeracy, for kindergarten, we know that's where they're going to end up, needing to know those skills or having those skills by the time they're
going to school. Next.
Absolutely, and that's the whole issue, or the whole initiative is to prepare the children for kindergarten.
Is there any data to show, I guess, what improvements we've seen, or I guess sustained improvement we've seen since we've had the bridge between the existing program and the new?
Give our preschool children pre-K PALS, which is a phonological literacy awareness screening.
Okay.
And that data, this children score extremely high, mm-hmm. that after they've been in the Head Start and BPI program. All of our children also take that type of assessment in kindergarten through third grade, so we're able to track the students. And the children that have been in these early programs have done extremely well in their literacy learning.
And again, the reason why you want to catch this early, so to speak, is that there's a preponderance of evidence, data, et cetera, that shows that if a child is not up to grade level at grade three, is this right? That you really are going to have a steep climb to try and bring them back up to speed.
It's our goal to ensure that all of our children in kindergarten through third grade are reading on or above grade level, because it is critical that they are on grade level by the end of third grade.
All right. Well, thank you guys for coming. Again, we have Carolyn Tyler, Head Start Manager with Richmond Public Schools, Ron Robertson, who's manager of the Virginia Preschool Program with Richmond Public Schools, and Vicki Oakley, Chief Academic Officer. Thank you guys again for coming out and talking with
us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And we say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Run, 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 run on.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, September 7th, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producer is Jay Westerman. Our associate producer is Gabby Schatzi. And our board op is Rachel Solomon. This and past episodes of Open Source RVA are now available to listen to anytime you want. Log on to the Open Source RVA Facebook page for links to our podcasts, as well as more information on the news featured each week on WRIR's Audio News Digest. Got a news tip? Want to give us your thoughts? Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. We'll meet you here next week for another edition of Open Source RVA. Suburban trees, suburban speed, and it smells like heaven. I said, run on it once, run on it twice, and the highways are neon. I love it, yeah.